All right, so I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation and KIDP for the hospitality, of course, and in general, the organizers for the Gravast 19 program. So as the title suggests, I'll tell you about binary black hole neutron stars. I was assigned with the task of telling you about black hole neutron stars, and given that I'm a numerical relativist by training, I can tell you about what black hole neutron star simulations in general relativity tell us. And I would like to shift a little bit the paradigm away so much from the kilonovae and maybe talk a little bit about short gamma ray bursts and what we have learned essentially from these simulations about the mechanism that might power these short gamma ray bursts, and maybe some new ideas on how to think about other electromagnetic counterparts and also other ways of constraining the equation of state. So let's talk about the elephant in the room. So have we detected a black hole neutron star in gravitational waves? There was this O3 super event, this S19-04-26C. It had a 13% chance of being a neutron star black hole binary. In fact, that was the motivation that Alberto provided to me in order to actually give this talk. So that's it, you know. That's my talk. But you know, as Duncan, is it? Well, I actually pulled it off the GCN website, so. Okay, all right. Fair enough. All right, so, but as Duncan might say, maybe even this number is actually not right and it has been updated, but the false alarm rate essentially is 1 per 1.676. I'm actually surprised by the number of significant digits on this number, but anyway, so probably it's not an event, but it's a trigger that may be something else, unless, of course, LIGO is withholding information in it. They're not telling us the entire story. Regardless, I think it is a matter of time until we see a black hole neutron star binary, and so let's see what we can learn essentially about these things. I don't think I need for this crowd to motivate these things, so I'm just going to skip this slide so that I don't have Ido at the end of the talk actually just flashing signs at me. So what about some new different ways of thinking about how we can constrain the equation of state? So this has been an idea that is completely born out of numerical relativity simulations and is the idea of the gravitational wave cutoff frequency. So basically, a binary black hole neutron star in spiral is not like a binary black hole in spiral or a binary neutron star in spiral. And the reason is that the neutron star can be tidally disrupted, which means that after the tidal disruption, the gravitational waves shut off. So numerical relativity simulations have found that this cutoff frequency, which is actually this is the characteristic strain versus frequency, that if you have different, these colored curves on this plot are actually different numerical relativity simulations, different equations of state, and you get this very sharp cutoff in the power in the gravitational waves. And as you increase or decrease the stiffness of the equation of state, so you actually become softer, this frequency cutoff is actually pushed to higher frequencies. So this correlation between the cutoff frequency and the equation of state is one way, essentially, to probe the neutron star equation of state in a just using gravitational waves alone. So Panarale, Francesco, and Emanuele Berti, who's here, actually derived a phenomenological model for feeding these gravitational waves to black hole neutron star binaries. Now you don't have to perform a gazillion simulations. You can just use this model to actually make predictions for the gravitational wave cutoff frequency. And so here on this plane, just for one equation of state, essentially, is the mass ratio of the binary versus the mass of the neutron star. And you can see the different values for the cutoff frequency. If we're at very low mass ratios, we're actually in the several kilohertz frequencies. So we really need to go to high mass ratio binary in spirals, which maybe good, because Chris actually sent me an updated plot of the population synthesis results before this talk actually started, then we might actually have very high mass ratio in spirals, in which case we might actually have cutoff frequencies that are larger, at smaller frequencies. But I think it might be challenging in the end, so we may actually need to go to 3G gravitational wave detectors. So Duncan, you can put this in your white paper, essentially, for motivating 3G detectors to some extent. All right, so what about electromagnetic counterparts? And in particular, I'm going to be focusing mostly on the what we can learn from simulations about gamma ray bursts. First of all, we need, at least from astrophysical plausibility point of view, we need to have some black hole with ejecta or matter outside the black hole horizon to generate an electromagnetic signal. You can, of course, come up with more exotic phenomena, which that's, you know, what most astrophysicists would agree on. So, but forming, actually, having matter outside black hole is not an easy thing, precisely because of the fact that the neutron star is highly disrupted. And in order to have matter, we have to disrupt the neutron star outside the innermost stable orbit of the black hole. So you can actually, you probably have done this order of magnitude calculation. Just in case you haven't done it, you can just take the tidal acceleration from the black hole on the neutron star surface, equate it to the self-gravity of the neutron star. You will derive what this tidal radius, or the tidal disruption radius is, assuming a 10 to 1 solar mass binary black hole neutron star, compactness of 0.2, that's about 2 times the gravitational radius of the black hole. So it's a very, very small distance. And the spin of the black hole will determine the innermost stable orbit, which, assuming a line black hole spin with the orbital angular momentum, is between 1 and 6 times the gravitational radius of the black hole. So if you really want to have an ISCO, which is less than 2 times the tidal disruption radius, so that the disruption takes place outside, then you need to have a spin that is about greater than 0.94, which is, depending on what limit you believe on black holes, that might actually be the maximum limit that astrophysical black holes can reach. So it's not an easy thing. One of the beauties of these black hole neutron star merger calculations compared to binary neutron star calculations is that they're actually a little bit easier in the sense that we don't really need to worry about magnetic fields. We don't need to worry so much about neutrino effects. Unlike the very messy collision that takes place during essentially a binary neutron star merger. And this statement actually just concerns only the point that I'm trying to make about finding how much mass outside the black hole remains. All these other effects are not, they're not dominant regarding that. So it's really the hydrodynamics that dictates what happens as far as how much mass stays out of the black hole. So there's been a bunch of numerical relativity simulations. I don't know if I've actually omitted people here, but predictions from numerical relativity have been quite abundant about how much mass there is outside there. They've been beautifully compiled by Foucault in 2012, who derived a fitting formula for all these predictions. And the way to read this plot, essentially, these plots here that are taken out of Foucault-François's paper, this is the black hole spin axis. The axis of, that has the y-axis, the black hole spin. This is the mass ratio of the binary. And these are how much mass you actually have left outside the black hole. If the red is no mass at all, blue is between 0.1 and 20% essentially of the initial rest mass, and greater than 20% of the rest mass. So if you take the most likely mass ratio, based on what Chris would actually tell you, which is about 7 to 1 for these black hole neutron star merger calculations, or from population synthesis, it's this 7, then if you want to have about 10% of a solar mass, you need a spin of 0.8. So it's not insignificant. I think it's a significant value for 0.8, especially if we believe that the recent calculations that black holes may not be highly spinning in the end. So I think there's a lot to be learned. And if you have, I forgot to say that this is for a neutron star compactness of 0.155, which is based, if you believe the constraints on the radii for neutron stars, this is actually borderline acceptable. If you go to the lower end of what is acceptable, let's say 9.5, 10-ish, then you actually, if you have a 7-to-1 mass ratio, you actually need to be almost nearly maximally spinning to get any mass outside the black hole. So this is going to be quite challenging. If this 0.1 solar mass is really what we need in order to explain gamma ray bursts and kilonovae at the same time, it looks like we're going to be needing spins that are going to be greater than 0.8. We'll see. It may be a strong constraint, maybe not, but it's a question mark, I would say. So one easy way one can evade that, of course, is if you include more parameters. There's eccentricity. We talked about globular clusters in this conference, so you might actually have the leverage additionally that is given by the eccentricity. In addition, globular clusters, more than 80% of observed pulsars, they actually millisecond. That means that they're rapid rotators, which means that they're more easily, you can unbind them more easily, essentially. You can tidal disrupt them further away compared to a neutron star that is not spinning. And so this is something that Will East, here on the left, and Franz Pretorius actually investigated a little bit back in 2015. We did hydro simulations. We took a 4-to-1 mass ratio black hole neutron star binary, zero spin for the black hole, and range the spin of the neutron star between 0 to 0.4. 0.4 is kind of like the limit of what we observe in our galactic neutron stars. And we took a fairly compact equation of state. That would be about 11 kilometers, essentially, for a neutron star, 11.2. If you do the simulation for a quasi-circular binary, you get zero mass. If you vary the eccentricity, you add the spin on top of that, you're going to get almost up to 20%, essentially, more mass compared to all these things. How frequent that is? I'll leave it to the people who actually do these calculations. I think it's just if we're looking for air gold mines, I think that would actually be one. And we can learn a lot of it, not only from the matter that is left outside, but also from the gravitational wave point of view. So what about short gamma ray bursts? I think one of the key things that we can answer with these types of simulations is, what is the mechanism that powers essentially a short gamma ray burst? And we can do all these calculations about how much mass, how much plausible, you know, something is. But I think it's going to be more like a 40, 50-year enterprise, I would say, similar to the supernova problem, essentially. What is the mechanism that powers a supernova? I think it's going to be a similar thing with these kinds of things, these kinds of mergers. There are two competing mechanisms. One is the magnetically powered, essentially, mechanism. The other is the neutrino annihilation mechanism. And we already are starting to actually probe both. So something that I've done quite a bit of work on is actually on the magnetic field side, essentially. This is work that I did with Milton Rees here on the left and Stu Shapiro when I was at the University of Illinois. We actually performed simulations for years of black hole neutron mergers, and we were trying to identify what it takes to actually launch a jet from these systems. And to cut the long story short, certainly you need to have mass outside the system quite a bit, but one of the key ingredients that turns out to be important is actually to have a magnetic field that is pulsar-like. Most simulations usually have the magnetic field confined in the interior. Anyone who's ever tried to do such a simulation, they all fail to generate an electromagnetic outflow. So this seems to be one of the important ingredients. It's actually not an easy thing to simulate. I'm not going to go into details, but the story basically is outlining these snapshots. This is at merger. This is about 90% of the mass of the neutron has been devoured by the black hole. And shortly after merger, we actually have this magnetic field winding that builds up the magnetic pressure above the poles and essentially just pushes the matter due to the magnetic pressure gradients that build up essentially above the black hole. And this engine can actually explain, at least energetically, let's say, the energetics of short gamma ray bursts and the time scales that we actually have. But it's certainly not a gamma ray burst. I'm just going to point that, which is why we actually attach the adjective incipient in front of the jet. So it's not even a relativistic jet. It's very, very mildly relativistic. What about the neutrino annihilation mechanism? So simulations today are quite advanced. We can actually do, not personally, but the community can actually do finite temperature, microphysics included, and some kind of neutrino transport as well in the simulation. So we can actually start to address questions about the neutrino annihilation mechanism. The neutrino annihilation mechanism, just in case you haven't heard, is basically these disks are hot. They generate a ton of neutrinos that are, electron neutrinos and anti-neutrinos. These annihilate into electron-positron pairs, and they can generate a gamma ray fireball, essentially. So that's the basic idea that goes with the gamma ray fireball. So it's the electron-positron pair gamma ray fireball model. So to get enough, essentially, of that, you need to have high neutrino luminosity, obviously. So these are some simulations that were performed by Kyotoku, actually just last year. This is just a plot of the plot of the mass versus time. It's the mass that's outside the horizon. And we get the standard thing that I told you earlier, stiffer equation of state, towards softer equation of state, essentially from top to bottom, and you get more mass the stiffer the equation of state. So you would think that, you know, more mass, probably it's more energetically favorable to do everything when it comes to gamma ray bursts. It turns out, however, that when it comes to the neutrino annihilation mechanism, the stiffer equation of state that has the most mass actually has the lowest luminosity, neutrino luminosity. So in fact, if you look at the peak luminosity, it's about a factor of two lower than the softer equation of state that is found in the simulation. So this points to a fact, the following conclusion, that stiff equations of state favor larger masses outside the black hole, but may disfavor short gamma ray bursts through the neutrino annihilation mechanism. I don't know if a factor of two is enough, but it may be some interesting interplay between the two things over there. All right, and as I said, I'm not going to be saying too much about Kilonovi, but I will discuss a little bit the connection with 170817. I mean, I owe to. One important thing that you have to keep in mind is that in contrast to binary neutron stars, to obtain a large neutron-rich ejecta disk masses from black hole neutron stars, we actually need a stiff equation of state. So we don't need a soft equation of state, we need a puffier star. And generally, simulations find that disk masses of order 0.1 solar masses are possible if you have moderately high black hole spin, so you can explain Kilonovi. This was put essentially to the test against GW170817 by Hinderer et al., who tried to model the event using a low mass black hole neutron star binary. And from the gravitational wave point of view, this is the phase difference versus frequency in the gravitational waves. The color curves are different neutron star simulations. The gray curves are numerical relativity simulations, assuming black hole neutron stars. The phase difference is not enough to say, to rule out, essentially, from the gravitational waves what is going on. These are the Kilonovi. Unfortunately, you cannot see the shaded regions. Actually, there's some shaded regions here that can actually fit the Kilonovi using the ejecta that they find and the mass that is outside the black hole. Bottom line, they find that if you actually do the parameter inference from the gravitational waves, and you, on top of that, you impose a cutoff on the mass that stays outside the black hole to be 0.1 solar mass in the baryons, you find that about 40% of the gravitational wave parameters are compatible with the electromagnetic observations. The neutron star constraints actually turn out to be much, much weaker. They're about from 11 to almost 15 kilometers in the mass ratio neutron star radius plane. So one complication is the neutron star spin. Because this is a low mass black hole neutron star binary, the neutron star spin, even if it's 0.1, can actually be quite significant. This is a simulation that Milton Rees is running right now. But it's for a black hole neutron star binary with a mass ratio of 5, and the black hole spin is 0. So if you, in fact, this is 0 mass outside the black hole, so this curve here, which corresponds to 0 spin and negative spin. But as you jack up the spin, you actually get about 1.5% in ejecta, essentially, because of the spin. And this is going to be much more significant if you actually have a lower mass ratio, which will affect these other previous calculations. All right, finally, I don't know if Sean is in the audience. I saw him earlier today, but there was an interesting thing just to think about other important effects that we can get from these black hole neutron stars. Sean McWilliams and Jan Levin in 2011, they actually proposed the unipolar inductor model for generating electromagnetic signals from the in-spiral phase, essentially, through magnetospheric interactions. This is an actual simulation of the system that I performed. In collaboration with Zach Etienne and Stu Shapiro. And they used the membrane paradigm, essentially. You always get a little bit nervous when people use the membrane paradigm, so I just wanted to actually see what comes out of the actual calculation. So this was the this is the result, that we actually do get a DC pointing outgoing pointing flux, essentially, from these systems. The luminosity is of order 10 to the 43 arcs per second, assuming a 10 to the 13 Gauss magnetic field in the pole of the neutron star. You can scale it down, actually, if you wanted to go to 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 10. It's a fairly powerful, as Lise Lehner would say, this is a pulsar on steroids. And energy can be extracted electromagnetically from these systems. The interesting result from these calculations is that if you look at the distribution of the pointing flux on the sky, it's actually quite isotropic. It's not a beamed thing. So this is the azimuthal direction, this is the polar direction, and this is the peak of the flux. And interestingly, as the binary in spirals, essentially the flux is scanning the sky. So this is the kind of signal that's how the pointing flux is directed. So this could be a characteristic quasi-periodic electromagnetic signature prior to merger. So I saw the stop talking sign. I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to leave my conclusions up here. I just want to say that I think numerical relativity is important for the field of joint gravitational wave and electromagnetic observations, and you know, for not only for interpreting observations, but also thinking about new avenues how to understand all these events. Thank you very much.
You have assumed black hole spins aligned with neutron star spin, is that right?
Correct.
If you allow for some inclination of neutron star orbit, that would help you a bit to lower black hole spins, is that right, and have more ejecta?
No, it's the opposite.
Opposite?
It's the opposite, yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes. The more you align, the less matter you get actually outside of the spin. There are simulations that have been performed, and they demonstrate clearly. You don't need a huge misalignment, however. I mean, you can actually start to see the severe... the severe decrease in the mass that is left outside above about 30 to 40 degrees misalignment. So in the context of leaving more mass outside, actually that means that you would need an even puffier star actually to have more mass left outside.
I'm going to ask a question based on some work that Ido did with Nick Stone. So, you know, so in this case, what do you expect if you have a misalignment between the spin and the disk? What do you expect that's going to do to the jet if you have precession of the disk? We are able to get a GRP precessing disk.
Now we're going to get into the regime. You know, what happens? Is the jet aligned with the black hole spin axis, or is it aligned with the angular momentum of the disk? I don't think it's a settled problem. There are simulations that are being performed. I think there are some recent simulations that have been performed by Matthew Liska, who did misaligned black hole spin accretion disks. Misaligned black hole spins with the orbital angular momentum of the accretion disk. And they were finding that there's actually a very interesting phenomenon, that it's not really aligned either with the orbital angular momentum or with the spin angular momentum of the black hole, but it's more aligned with the black hole spin closer to the black hole, but then once you get out, actually it aligns more with the orbital angular momentum of the disk. So given the precession, maybe at far away, you may actually see a precessing jet based on these calculations, but I think there's more work that needs to be done.
Just a quick comment. I think for that sort of thing, like precessing jets around black holes, that's still a very new field, and
yes,
no simulations have gone far and reached steady state out to large radii.
I completely agree, which is
take
why...
Take all of that with a large grain of salt.
Yeah, which is why I'm saying that it's not a settled question. It's a...
From your jet simulations, do you see any kind of correlation between the mass ratio and the jet luminosity?
I can speculate, but I have not done the simulation to tell you exactly. So one of the important results, essentially, that have been borne out of the simulations on single, of isolated, just accretion onto a single black hole, not these kinds of simulations, is that the jet luminosity depends on the amount of flux that you actually, the poloidal flux that you accrete onto the black hole. So my speculation is that if you actually have a larger mass ratio, then everything else being equal, you're going to have a much smaller disk outside, so you're going to have less flux, magnetic flux, that you can accrete into the black hole, which should lead essentially to a less powerful outflow, electromagnetic outflow. So, you know, but that would be my expectation.
So following up on something that was discussed earlier, so given that the equation state is looking like it's on the softer side, and then you need higher spins to overcome larger mass ratios, which you might expect in these systems, are we kind of, you know, screwed for channels that might produce those type of things? And so it'll be low events, that low number of NS.
Can I show your plot? and maybe we can actually discuss this. So this is the fresh out of the oven. Oops. you should blame Chris for that. I forgot how you actually flip it, but maybe we can just look at it like this. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So this is the plot that Chris sent me, and it's not entirely clear because the here it sounds like you're actually looking at the mass ratio distribution. Okay. So it's mass of the black hole versus essentially mass of the black hole, just the probability. Yeah, the probability. Yeah. Okay. And so it seems like it's around, what, 8, 9 solar masses, something like that. And so if you take a nominal 1.4 solar mass neutron star, it's, what, mass ratio of 6, 7, something like that. So you would need a fairly high spin. But there's also a significant number down here. I don't think, well, maybe not down here, but maybe here, but maybe, you know, this, which is what, like 10% of the peak, you know, maybe there will be a number of events if this is right.
Obviously, I would get to many more Lola black holes if I filled the first mass gap, which we don't know if it exists or not yet.
Okay.
This assumes a full mass gap. First, yeah, so I start formation of black holes at 5 right. Instead of, let's say, 3.
I have a question about the unipolar inductor.
Mm-hmm.
So you were happy about the luminosities that were coming out. My question is, from a detectability point of view, do we have any idea in what part of the spectrum this 10 to the 43 amp per second?
If I were to put my money on something, that would be on gamma rays.
So 43 amp per second is not good enough.
Yeah, I know. But essentially, that would be motivated more from pulsar, gamma ray pulsar luminosities, essentially. That if you look at the spin down power, usually, and you have a gamma ray pulsar, you know, that is what nearly matches essentially the spin down power. So maybe something like that. But you're right, it wouldn't help.
Can you say one thing, which is just, I mean, you're predicting a pointing flux, but you're also predicting a pointing flux which is increasing in power, right, as the thing spins spiral.
It's a good point. This particular calculation actually takes advantage of the symmetries of the initial data. It doesn't in spiral.
Okay.
It actually just rotates the space-time. So it just takes advantage of the fact that there's a what we would call a killing vector in the space-time to actually perform the calculation. So this is just doing the calculation to achieve the steady state. Strictly speaking, that's where you actually have to start to do the in-spiral and see how it goes then. There are predictions that indeed it increases as you in-spiral. And this is about 7, 8 orbits before merger, so you do expect to see a peak as this thing goes up, yeah. But I don't think you would get much more than an order of magnitude increase, at least starting from these separations.
Okay, but you're...
Yeah.
I'm just meaning that if you have a flow which is changing in properties, you can get things like internal magnetized shocks, which people have hypothesized might give rise to fast radio bursts. So there's some hope, possibility, that, you know, if there's any self-interaction between this flow, that mm-hmm. maybe you could get something other than gamma rays.
I completely agree.
You should look.
I completely agree. And there's also another thing is that there was I was reading one of the LISA documents recently, that if you have a neutron star, you just throw it into a black hole, you don't get an electromagnetic counterpart, which is not entirely true, because there's a magnetosphere that has to be radiated away. So there's certainly a lot of energy in the magnetosphere that you can radiate away. And there are estimates that you can also do to see what kind of power you would expect in that. And it typically matches essentially those of fast radio bursts.
Other questions?
Is there any hallmark observable from a gamma ray burst that would tell you the difference between a binary neutron star versus a neutron star black hole engine?
I don't think we have enough simulations to say for sure, or that we have reached the level of sophistication in the simulations to be able to discern the two. Having said that, however, because I have done simulations of binary neutron stars that demonstrate the same behavior with magnetic fields, what the simulations of binary neutron stars indicate is that the jets, at least at the level that we can actually see them, they're further collimated compared to the black hole neutron star cases. So that might indicate that you maybe achieve higher Lorentz factors compared to what you can achieve in the black hole neutron star case. Maybe.
Well, the rates ultimately should tell you.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Sure.